You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices, and I'm Shemaine Montana, and here with me is our regular co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Another beautiful day. I could handle this till next time. This year, next time.
We're having just about perfect weather this week.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's supposed to last for a while, too.
Great. Well, today we're talking with Victoria Moran, author of Living a Charmed Life, Your Guide to Finding Magic in Every Moment of Every Day. Victoria Moran is a motivational speaker, certified life coach, and best-selling author, including Fat, Broke, and Lonely No More, Lit from Within, Fit from Within, Younger by the Day, Shelter for the Spirit, and Creating a Charmed Life, which was translated into 29 languages and quoted on Celestial Seasonings teas.
Wow.
So as a 10th anniversary sequel, she's written Living a Charmed Life. And that's new this year, and we're very excited to be able to talk to Victoria. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So tell us, Victoria, what is a charmed life?
It's one that's worth waking up for. You know, it's just the idea of having a life that works. If you think back to what you really thought life could be when you were a little kid, when you're living a charmed life, you know that's it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're richer than most people or prettier than most people. It just means you're happier than most people.
That's a good definition. So what made you decide to write this book and its predecessor?
The predecessor was actually going to be something else. The proposal that I wrote back in 1998 was called God on the Go, A Busy Woman's Guide to the Spiritual Life. They liked the ideas. They liked the busy woman part, they meaning the publisher, HarperCollins.
Yeah.
But they asked me two things. One, they said, can you do it in these little chapters? At that time, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff was very big. So they wanted these little snippets. And I said, well, of course, because I've learned in this business that when anybody says, can you do something, the answer is always yes. And then they said, can you do it without the word God? We're afraid that we might lose some people that way. So I went back to the drawing board and recreated the idea about having a wonderful life, even in the busyness of our modern times. And, of course, that wasn't even really busy because that was before most people had lots of email and online things to do. But, you know, we thought we were busy then. and it became Creating a Charmed Life, which is 75 tiny chapters, sensible spiritual secrets every busy woman should know. And that book just has been amazing. Around the world, people love it. People keep buying it and tell their friends. And I've had some good luck with books. I've been on Oprah a couple of times. I've been in USA Today. I've really been blessed by the book gods. Creating a Charmed Life didn't get any of that. And yet, just the word of mouth made it the biggest selling book that I've ever had.
Wow.
HarperCollins at the Book Expo in 2007, one of the vice presidents was talking to me and saying, you know, we really should do a 10th anniversary sequel. And I thought, okay, fine, more of the same. I can do that. But then some very difficult things went on in my life and my family. We had a tragic death of a young member of our family, and things seemed very bleak. So as I wrote Living a Charmed Life, I felt that every day I really had to prove that even in the hard times, this was possible. Mm-hmm. And when the book came out in May of this year, I realized that I was writing to people who were going through the same kinds of doubts and fears because of what's going on in the economy as I was going through because of what was going on personally. So it just all seems to be book magic and getting it out there at the right time.
Right. I appreciated how in the beginning of the book you talked about how living a charmed life isn't about bad things never happening to you. It's about finding what's charming in the midst of hard times.
I think think that's the only way to do it. And I know that there are a lot of books out there that imply that if everything isn't perfect, that if all of your dreams haven't come true already, if you're not living in the 52-room mansion by the sea, there's just something wrong with your attitude or your outlook or how you're doing things. When I think what's really wrong is you just decided to come to Earth and be human, because here things are difficult and taxing and trying, and yet that's part of the wonder. I live in New York City now, which I dearly love, and I love having New York adventures. So last weekend, my husband and I decided to explore Soho block by block, found a sample sale. I bought this really cute dress. I was saying to myself, is it too young? And then I answered myself back, well, maybe, but if you wait, you'll be even older. So I bought it, brought it home. I realized that on the label, this company, Anzivino and Florence, has a little tagline, and it says, sometimes catastrophes become trophies. And I think that's important to remember.
Yeah. A favorite songwriter of mine says, each day it's less like scars and more like character.
Ooh, nice.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Well, in spite of the fact that your publisher wanted you in the original book to not use the word God, although I have to say I think that's a really cute title, God on the Go. But they didn't want you to use the word God, but in spite of that, this is a very spiritual book.
Yes, and I use whatever words I want.
Yeah, and I enjoyed your words. I enjoyed the universal kind of tone of it, so that it was very, very deep and profound insights, and yet you spoke in a language that many people could appreciate. How did you have to work hard at that?
No, because that's how I live. That's just how I am. I'm so fascinated by the big picture and the deep meanings. My degree is in comparative religions. I couldn't imagine studying anything that wasn't involved with the whole cosmic meaning of life. And yet, I also just really love the little things. I mean, I'm a very girly girl, and I think it's really fun to find a fabulous new lipstick color. So I can be all over the place with the joy of the little things and the wonder of the big picture. And I think we're really all like that. I think that's what makes a whole human being, and I like to write to my reader as a whole person.
Well, you accomplished that very well. In fact, it's the format and tone of the book is very light and humble, and a fun kind of coffee table book or something to read for 5 minutes of inspiration each day. So it's got a light and fun kind of girly girl tone to it, and yet there's this tremendous depth. It's really wonderful. So, can you tell us more about your spiritual background and some of your favorite spiritual teachers?
Oh, yes. Well, I suppose my favorite spiritual teacher was the woman who was hired to take care of me when I was 6 months old. Parents had no idea that she was very big in unity. She'd been in Christian Science. She'd studied Rosicrucianism. And when I would ask her a question about something, she would often give me a quotation from Emerson as the answer. So I was really, really lucky to have this early on. I think that I needed her. An astrologer once told me that she was really my parent, that my parents had provided the body the ability to come together with this woman, because I was looking for that kind of life, I believe, myself. My first spiritual experience was in the stroller. I was not quite three, because we moved on my third birthday, so I know we were in our first house. And Dee Dee, this nanny, had taken me out at nighttime. It was very dark, but there was a new moon and lots of stars, and I remember thinking there in the stroller, well, that's home up there in the stars, and this is fine. This is good. I'm doing this. But it ain't home. Now, I don't know if a lot of two-year-olds have experiences like that, but I know that I did, and that's kind of been characteristic of my life. I understand that I'm here on this earth to learn what I need to learn here, to do what I need to do here, express what I need to do here, and I am fully willing to be totally present for as long as I'm here and make this magnificent. And yet, I also believe with everything that's in me that this is just part of a bigger whole. In fact, one of my favorite book titles is A Parenthesis in Eternity by Joel Goldsmith. I love that idea that, yeah, this is a very big picture, and here we are making this incredible 90-year parenthetical statement. How cool is that?
That's nice. So any more great spiritual teachers along the way?
You know, gosh, there have been so many. I got into yoga at 17, and my first yoga teacher in England, Stella Chirfas, was very inspirational to me because at that time, people confused yoga and yogurt, and both were just seen as weird. So from Kansas City, my hometown, to London, where it was quite a bit less weird, and get just truly into this bigger way of seeing things. I also had some exposure to the Maharishi Yogi early on, and not directly, but I was Ace Girl reporter. I sent $1 to a teen magazine when I was 14 to get a press card, which anybody could get, but I was very serious about mine, and got into my first Beatles press conference at 14 and again at 15. And when I was 16, I met Mal Evans, who was one of the Beatles managers. And at 18, when I was living in London, and that was after the Beatles had started meditating, and of course all their entourage went along and did everything they did. Mm-hmm. And I remember speaking with Mal one night and just saying, "This is so magnificent. This is spiritual. It's just really, really all that's important." And he was so cute. He was much older than me. He was in his 30s. I was 18. And he kind of chuckled, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I've been everywhere, and I've done everything, and you're right. That's really all there is." So that was a good one. Learned to meditate at that time. And then there've just been a lot of people that nobody's heard of. In the 1980s, I was living back in my hometown of Kansas City, and my first husband died very suddenly and obviously very young. Our daughter was 4 years old. And the minister at the Unity Church, a fellow named Max Lasser, just swooped in like an angel and carried me through this really difficult time. And he taught me about things like tithing. I remember at that time when things were really hard, I explained to him once that I couldn't very well give 10% of my income that week because my income had been $200, and after I paid everything, I'd only have $20 left, so I couldn't very well give that away. And he said, "I guess in your situation," and I was expecting him to say, of course not, you must keep your $20. He said, "I guess you have no choice." So these wonderful memories just come along, and I think, too, some of my great spiritual teachers are friends. There's a chapter in Living a Charmed Life called Gather the Gurus, which is really about our wonderful friends. And for most women, it's a lot of wonderful girlfriends. Mm-hmm. I have one right now. Her name is Sherry Boone. She's a magnificent Broadway and opera singer. She's just remarkable. And we talk every day. We're action partners. We share what we're going to do that day to get closer to our dreams. And Sherry is just positive. I'll say, "How you doing?" And she'll say, "Blessed and highly favored." Kind of annoy me. It's like, okay, do. But now I'm used to it.
Yeah.
And I really, really look up to her. Another great Sherry story was a couple of years ago when Toni Morrison retired as an adjunct professor at Princeton. They gave her a wonderful send-off at Jazz at Lincoln Center in New York City, and Sherry was one of the entertainers who sang that evening. And it was a very sedate crowd, and no one had gotten any standing ovations, even though they'd all been wonderful. And I was just at the edge of my seat, and I knew that no matter what, as soon as Sherry finished singing, I was going to jump up and be on my feet for her. But I didn't get a chance to be the first one because this upstart in the front row was standing first, and that happened to be Bill Clinton.
Wow.
So the next morning, Sherry called me on the way to the airport where she was going to do one of her after-day jobs, which was helping tour groups getting from plane to plane. And she was just as committed to helping the senior citizen tourists from Seattle as she had been to saying thank you to the former president. There was no difference. And when I see that in a peer, mm-hmm. not some famous spiritual teacher, not some historic personage, but just somebody else that I can look across at and have tea with and see spirit working in her in that way, I just feel like I'm pretty lucky.
Mm. You bet.
Yeah, speaking of girlfriends as spiritual teachers, I've been known to tithe to my girlfriends now and then because I think, well, where have I received my spiritual nourishment between now and the last time I tithed? And it's clearly and only girlfriends sometimes.
Wow, I love that.
Yeah.
What a fabulous idea. I'm going to start.
Yeah, because, you know, that's God's money, in my opinion. So where does it need to go but where we receive our spiritual food?
Beautiful.
Yeah. So you tell a story early in the book about someone who helped you feel worthy. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah.
Was that a girlfriend?
With the previous book, with Fat, Broken, Lonely, No More, and I was out in Marin County, California, going to lunch with a friend that I hadn't seen in a while. So she took me to this wonderful, very Californian restaurant. It's called Cafe Gratitude. There are several of them in Northern California, and I think one or two in the L.A. area as well. We were in, I believe, Fairfax, California, and this restaurant is all vegan, mostly raw, and the menu is a whole listing of affirmations. Every single food item, every appetizer, every entree, every dessert, every beverage is an affirmation. So instead of just saying, you know, I'll have the spinach salad and the nut pate, you get to say, I'll start with I am grateful, and then let's have some I am generous. So I hadn't really paid attention to what I was ordering because I was talking with my friend. But when the server came back with the dish, she looked me in the eye and said, you are worthy. And I was really taken aback because people tell me lovely things all the time. I'm very blessed in good words coming to me from people. And I think we all are. You know, we hear, oh, you're such a good friend. I appreciate you so much. I love your haircut. But when did anybody ever say, you are worthy? And it was disconcerting because I felt like after, at that time, 9 self-help books, I really had to own that no matter what had happened, no matter what anybody had ever thought about me or said about me, I needed to truly accept that I was worthy or send my tofu and quinoa back to the kitchen. So I just had to take it in. And, of course, with great humility, because you go along in life and you think you know things, and this young woman who said you are worthy was about 23 and had a whole bunch of tattoos and piercings. One more guru.
Hmm.
She told me what I absolutely had to accept for going forward. And one of the old messages that had tended to hang around in my head was, who do you think you are? Whenever these amazing things happen, these just beyond, oh, this can't be happening. Who do you think you are? And to change that around to, how about, who do you know you are? Because nothing comes into our lives that isn't supposed to be there. So we may as well just accept, appreciate, and enjoy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think maybe the reason some people get terribly down on life is because they can't appreciate the goodness in them, in themselves.
Yes.
And because we all have goodness in us. Sometimes it's pretty well hidden, but it is there, and we have, you know, we have chances to use it every day if we just look around. You know, a good prayer to start with every day is Lord, help me to take me places where I can do your work.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Take me places where I can do your work.
Yeah, because we are his hands and voice and you know.
So true.
There are a lot of opportunities.
Several essays in this book, this might not seem connected, but it is to me. several essays in this book talk about physical well-being. And to me, physical well-being is what allows us to do the work of spirit. And it's what allows us to experience the spirit. It's hard to feel the spirit if your body hurts, you know, and so physical well-being is important. Will you tell us what your philosophy on that is and why you included so much in this book?
Well, I completely agree with you, and I find it so interesting that Western spirituality, to a great extent, has ignored the body, because the analogy that I like to use is to think of one of those beautiful old wooden radios, and if you think of your body as that radio, and you tune the radio, and you tune it over here, and you get some talk, and here's some golden oldies, and here's some hip-hop, and here's some classical music, just depending on where you tune it. And I see that this body radio is a receiver like that for the kind of vibrations, the kind of radio waves we really want to come into us and express in our lives. And we tune that radio by what we feed ourselves, and it's what we feed ourselves physically, mentally, and spiritually. So, of course, we want to be around positive company. We want to be getting good ideas fed to us, lots of truth. I'm a strong believer in memorization, memorizing poems, passages, songs, scripture, whatever it is that's uplifting. So when you're alone and afraid, that comes up to be a companion. But in the very, very basic physical body structure, we're creating ourselves, and we can only take in what our cells can appropriate and understand. So how much sleep we get, how much exercise, and what kind, protecting ourselves from environmental toxins, whether we ingest them or breathe them, and eating the very, very best food we can possibly get. It's extremely important. I mean, the yogis knew this 5,000 years ago, and a lot of people know it now, but if you walk around a mall in America, you wouldn't think very many people did.
Yeah. And there's this sort of paradox that I think about, that sometimes illness befalls you, and it just doesn't seem like your fault. And so to say that physical well-being is essential to spiritual attunement feels perhaps not fair. I mean, anybody can connect, I believe, and yet
seems a bit arrogant for those of us who do not have ailments, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps. You know, so I always want to be fair and not suggest that, oh, you know, you're sick, or I've had my share of health problems. You know, oh, if you're sick, you can't connect, you can't tune in. But yet, it just is really important. It's hard to, like I say, feel the spirit when your body
hurts.
Your
spirit is down.
Yeah.
I think it's so much about how you care for yourself, regardless of what state your body is in at any given moment. And this can be about health and sickness. This can be about the vitality of youth or the slowing down in old age.
Yeah.
It's how you care for yourself in whatever circumstance that you're in.
Yeah. Well, let's see. What else? Can you tell us the difference between your first book and your second book? Is it just kind of more of the same, or is there a whole different tone to it?
Well, I thought it was going to be more of the same until the events transpired in my own life and then in the world at large that kind of changed the second one. The first book, Creating a Charmed Life, is just a lovely guide to living beautifully and richly and enjoying yourself and finding the delights. And it's still a great book. I think it's really going to be a book that lives on for a very, very long time. It came for me out of a time of great joy in my life. I had been a single mom for 9 years, and I met this wonderful man, and a year later we got married, and about 5 months after that, I started writing this book. Mm. So there was just all of this energy going on in my life. My daughter was 14, a young actress, homeschooling, you know, busy, busy. My stepchildren were with us part of the time. They were much younger, so they had brought more of that, you know, wonderful child energy into our lives. We had 4 cats and a dog. And so it was that wonderful, as I say in the introduction to this book, I wrote that one out of the good wet clay of busyness and energy. Mm-hmm. And I think that energy is what's really given that book its power and the reason that people love it so much. Mm-hmm. This new one, Living a Charmed Life, is a little more mature and perhaps sober in a way, although it's still lighthearted and humorous, because I think if you lose your humor, you know, you better just rethink things. But there's much more to this, like, okay, sometimes things don't work out the way you want them. What about, let's say, everything falls apart? So one of the essays in Living a Charmed Life is called Recreate a Charmed Life if you have to.
Mm.
Sometimes there is a death or a divorce or a tornado or a pink slip, and whatever it is, you've got to rebuild again. So how do you do that? How can you even feel that it's not silly to think that you could have a charmed life after something really serious takes place? So I'd say they're similar, but one really does build on the other. And this one, Living a Charmed Life, is very much about living a charmed life in the times we're in right now. The economy is doing what it's doing. The environment is doing what it's doing. We need to respond to these things and still make magic every single day.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goal of living a charmed life.
Well, you need to decide what a charmed life is for you, too.
Mm-hmm.
A charmed life for me may not be the same as Shemaine's ideal life, right?
Right.
And it, you know, you have to make that decision.
Yeah.
It's totally customized. That's the wonderful thing, that people, if you ask 50 people, what's your dream, I think we might get a little bit of a skewed result nowadays because the media has told us, well, your dream is supposed to be that you're tall and thin and rich and 500,000 people know who you are. But if we can get past that down to what people really want, it's very different.
Mm-hmm.
Some people want to be out in the country growing food. Some people want to be in the middle of a great big city. Some people really do want to be in the center of the spotlight, and that's where they come to life. And somebody else wants to be in a library or in a research facility discovering things. And to really know what your heart's desire is and achieve that, well, it's pretty charmed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite concepts in your book is stay close to the things that make you come alive.
Yeah.
And even if you feel a sense of not enoughness, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money to pursue these things, it's so important to know what really makes you come alive and just do it.
Yes, and most of them don't take a whole lot of time or money.
Yeah.
When you really get down to it, and this is why I'm such a fan of journaling, it just seems like if you pick up a pen and list what really makes me come alive, A, B, C, D, it's very unlikely going to be owning a yacht would make me come alive. I mean, maybe for some people, but probably if that's on your list, then owning a yacht wouldn't be a big deal. You could just go get one.
Right.
But for most of us, that's not going to be there. But some of these other things, like playing the piano, maybe you need to get it tuned, but that's really all. Or reading every day. My daughter said to me not long ago, I think I would die if I didn't have a library card.
Oh, golly.
That.
You know, I have given piano lessons for a long, long time, and I've talked to many, many adults who wish they had not stopped taking lessons. I never talked to one that was glad they did. They wish they had kept, because they really, it's really something they would love to do.
Yeah. And the more skill you have, the more fun it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. My list is very simple. Singing, dancing, writing, pretty old-fashioned dresses, and doggies.
And
none of them cost a lot of money to stay close to.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us, what is the Cosmic Two-Step?
Yeah, thank you. That's one of my favorite of the little 50 essays in Living a Charmed Life. The Cosmic Two-Step is getting what you want in life. It's a technique for getting what you want in life. So if you're a person who prays, this is a lovely way to pray. And if you're a very pragmatic person who's more interested in the material world, this is actually an insight into how the universe works. So step one of the two-step is ask for what you want, and step two is let it go. Leave it alone. Universe, work on it. So my guide for asking is Scarlett O'Hara in the Sweet Potato Field in Gone with the Wind, because she's not out there asking in some wimpy sort of way, maybe it would be nice to have some more food. No. Grabbing that red terra clay, and she says, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again. She means it.
Yeah.
And so, result of that, she gets a divine idea. Take down the curtains, get a dress made, go visit Rhett in prison. So we follow up on the divine ideas that come as a result of asking, but other than that, we let it go. So often, we'll ask, and then we'll change it, and then we'll want to fix it, and then we'll want to mess with it, and then we'll want to alter it. Well, no wonder it doesn't happen, because we're just not clear. But if you ask and mean it, and let it go, and go about living a charmed life today, your odds of coming into what you want, if not specifically exactly what you ordered, but something pretty darn close and even more wonderful, that's going to happen for you a lot more often than it used to.
Maybe the trick is, is not looking at someone else and saying, okay, I want to be that. I want to be like that. I want to have that life. You have your own life.
Exactly.
And what works for you and what worked for that person may not work for you. I think we all try to be too much like everybody else and somebody else and not embracing ourselves.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite concepts from the book is embrace all of your different aspects. And so embracing who you are, even if you're full of paradoxes.
Yeah.
Because I think
we all are. Absolutely.
Our paradoxes can be disturbing to other people, because it's comforting to us if we can put other people in boxes. Then we know exactly where they belong and exactly where they fit. I found many years ago, because I'm a vegetarian, a lot of people would say, oh, then you must garden.
Yeah.
Well, I don't. And I love farmers markets. I'm thrilled with people who do garden. It's just not my thing. But so many people just couldn't get it that if I ate vegetables, why didn't I want to grow them? Well, I don't know why, just don't. And so to be able to accept within myself, I have this part of me that fits other people's opinion of what vegetarian means, but I don't have this other part, and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. I'm on the page where you talk about that, and I just felt so vindicated when you were listing some of these assumptions that are made. Artists are starving. Successful people are cutthroat. Activists are extremists. Idealists are unrealistic. Attractive people are shallow. And the list goes on and on. And I was just cheering. I was saying, yeah. I somehow want to encapsulate this on a T-shirt. Don't box me in. Well, you are listening to KRUU 100.1 FM in Fairfield, Iowa, and today we are talking to Victoria Morin, author of Living a Charmed Life, Your Guide to Finding Magic in Every Moment of Every Day. Thank you again for being with us, Victoria. Can you tell us about the inner epicure and the inner chaperone?
The inner epicure and the inner chaperone live with you. They're inside you. They came along with you when you showed up on the planet. The inner Epicure is there to help you enjoy the sensory delights of living, and the inner Chaperone is there so that you'll know when enough is enough. She is that part inside you that says, ding, 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 this is where peak experience ends and downhill from here starts. So your inner Chaperone is the one that you want to call on whenever you're just not quite sure if you're going to go overboard. So one of the things that I say in the book is in the buffet line or the outlet mall, when you're leaving a voicemail message or explaining your position, when you're flirting with a fellow or salting the soup, stop just before you want to, just before what you think the stopping point is. That way you'll never overstep it. That's where your inner Chaperone comes in. She's the one who'll tell you, whoa, enough is enough.
That's a nice concept, to listen to those voices.
Yes, if we heed them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like having a hunch about something and not following it and then realizing later, oh my gosh, if I had just followed that hunch, you know.
Yeah. And then you get hit by the cosmic 2x4.
Yeah.
It has to yell louder and louder. You have another unique idea in your book that we're supposed to love the people, places, and jobs that we don't think we like very much and we want to get away from, but you're suggesting we try on to love them.
This is because we have this idea that once you love something, you're stuck to it. And obviously, that's true in many cases. I mean, you look your baby in the eye the first time and you're in love forever. You may be in love with a cause, in love with work that you do. But the other job that love can do in our lives is cosmic Gugon. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
Sticky thing on the mirror that price tag left and you can't scrape it off. You put on some Gugon and it just disappears. Well, love can be like that as well. Because when things come up that are difficult, there's some kind of lesson there, some kind of karmic little incident that we need to learn from. But what happens when the job that we thought was going to be so great just gets stifling and awful, when this person that we're in a relationship with that we thought was going to be Mr. Right turns out to be, oh, very, very wrong, when we move into an apartment that we thought was going to be ours forever and then we realize that the neighbors are in a rock band and there's a leak in the ceiling, we start to hate it. It just get me out of here. Just get me to the point where this lease is up. Just get me to where I can find another job. I've got to get out of it. And every day as we plan our leaving, we put more negativity on the present situation. Well, what happens is later we're going to come back to that. Different zip code, different time zone, names and faces change to protect the innocent, but it's the same experience playing out over and over again, because the ultimate lesson of every life situation is how to love. So you save yourself a lot of time and aggravation if you love the thing already. Okay, this job is not using my skills and abilities to the degree that I thought it would. So I am going to finish up this job to the very best of my ability. I'm going to leave everything in perfect shape for the next person who comes. I'm going to love everybody who works here. I'm going to love this desk. I'm going to love these pencils. I'm going to love the person who takes over the job, and I'm going to go on to the next thing. Same thing with relationships. It is not working. We're going to end this thing. I wish you well. From the very depths of my being, I love you as the human being that you are. I release you to your highest good and really, really mean it. Because if that doesn't happen, then the next job or the next relationship won't look at the beginning like it's a clone of the other one. But sure enough, it'll be that. And if not the very next one, it'll be one down the road. Mm-hmm. So just keep on progressing by loving everything as it exits from your life, and then you get only new wonderful experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great philosophy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I love the principle of trying on gratitude, and then you find reasons to be grateful.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Only after you try it on. Yeah.
That was one of Oprah's things, a gratitude journal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I've done that.
I have too.
Every night I bought a cute little notebook that has lined paper in it, and every night I have to fill up each line with something to be grateful for. And for the first few, it's kind of hard. But then after a while, I could fill a whole book.
You know? It's fun to look back and see what, you know, see how you progress too, doesn't
it? Yeah. Well, Victoria, would you like to do a reading, and then we can talk more about your writing process itself?
Oh, sure. Oh, I'd love to do that. I actually would like to read something that you asked about earlier, Enlist Your Inner Epicure, Chapter 3 in Living a Charmed Life. Pleasure is good for you. When you can run into, where you can run into trouble is looking for pleasure that isn't worthy of you. Accepting junk, rather in the form of merchandise, food, or relationships, does not, cannot provide us with genuine pleasure. As a result, we often go for more junk and end up disliking ourselves because we look over our lives and don't see the quality we long for. There is happy news. Your rescuer is at hand. She resides inside you in the form of your inner epicure. This is the part of you that delights in the pleasures of being alive. Fine food and drink, romance, friendship, travel, the assorted sensory and intellectual delights that are yours to sample simply because you had the nerve to show up on this demanding planet and star in your own life. It's common to keep the inner epicure hidden away. We're afraid that she's a glutton, a trollop, and a dilettante, some shameful aspect of ourselves that is endlessly greedy and self-absorbed. Not true. She's the part of you that enables you to enjoy your very own life. It probably is more blessed to give than receive, but this particular aspect of your personality is here to help you relish the receiving piece. The only time she'll get out of hand and start pillaging chocolate shops and picking up traveling salesmen is when you deny her until she just can't take it anymore. You call on her by developing a healthy respect for pleasure and doing what you can to get all you need. She's there when you take the time to savor delicious meals, wear clothing that feels smooth and soothing next to your skin, and sleep on a comfortable bed with a heavenly pillow or a pile of them. She's happy when you laugh enough and love enough. She cheers when you allow your body to have needs and you're not embarrassed about meeting them. She's packed and ready to roll when you set out to sample new delights, refining your preferences and expanding your scope as you do. When you're on board with your inner epicure, you take great care of your physical self, but you're never one of those women who don't eat or who, if they do, say something ridiculous like, "I'm being so bad." You give your sex life time and attention. If it's not as scrumptious as it ought to be, you find ways to spice it up. You allocate some of your budget for movies or theater or massage, whatever it is that makes you feel that you're not just working to stay afloat, but reveling in the voyage. You strengthen this partnership by remembering that you are a grown-up. You're well aware of what you like. You need no one's permission to meet your needs and experience whatever physical, mental, or spiritual deliciousness appeals to you right now. Other than in extraordinary circumstances, you don't have to check out your choices with someone who knows more. Who could possibly know more about what makes you happy than you? Your inner epicure has certain standards. She isn't fond of settling, but if extenuating circumstances make this necessary, she'll help you settle with style. Dinner may be rice and beans, but you can serve it on your mother's china, set the table with old silver, and snip some lilacs from the garden as a centerpiece. The pleasure seeker inside you is keenly aware that this is her shot. You are an eternal being. You've been around forever, and you'll last as long as the heavens. Your inner epicure, however, is part of your physical life, this physical life. She doesn't have forever, and she puts great stock in the moment at hand. let her come out to play. She'll lead you to the tastiest strawberries, the prettiest dresses, and the most scrumptious love affairs, even if you have those liaisons all with one person. When she gets her due, your inner Epicure is a great friend of your health and happiness. She has no interest in overdoing, and she doesn't want you harmed even a little bit. Why would she? You're the only way she gets to eat the strawberries and wear the dresses. Listen, she's talking to you, telling you to live a little, do it. You'll both be a great deal happier. And the lucky charm for this essay, each one of the 50 chapters ends with a lucky charm, a little suggestion for putting it into practice, and that is do something intensely gratifying within the next 24 hours, and after you do, have no regrets.
So, did your Epicure encourage you to buy that dress?
Yeah, I guess she did.
You were speaking my language about the pretty dresses.
Yeah.
That's great. So when in your life did you decide that you wanted to be a writer? Are you still there? Did we lose you? Okay, it looks like we lost Victoria.
Oh, no.
But she will call back undoubtedly.
Oh, golly.
There she is.
She's calling. Well, somebody's calling. I hope it's her. Wonder how that happened. Well...
Hi, Victoria. Hang on, let's take a little musical interlude. Hi, Victoria. Hold on a second. Okay, have we got you back? Have we got you back, Victoria? Okay, one moment while I put on some music. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, and this is Writers' Voices. I'm Chemaine Montana with Caroline Kilborn today, and we're talking to Victoria Moran, author of Living a Charmed Life. Welcome back, Victoria.
Thank you.
So when in your life did you first think about being a writer? And is that all you do, or do you do other things?
Oh, good
as a career?
Big questions. Been a writer from early in childhood, probably around sixth grade. I think it was my sixth grade teacher that suggested that I go into journalism. Before that, I'd wanted to be an actress and went through a time of wanting to be a lawyer because I thought it was all about appealing to a jury. Found out it was a lot more other things. So I've always written, and I did start writing for publication for the teen magazine when I was 14, mm-hmm. and I really haven't stopped. My gift from God is words, and I can do words written and spoken, so I'm also a professional speaker. Mm-hmm. And those are the two things that I really know how to do. I do other things with my life. I'm a certified life coach, and I do spiritual life coaching, and that's wonderful. I love my clients to pieces, and yet there's work there. I really have to give that a kind of energetic attention that's coming from myself in a way that with the writing and the speaking, I just show up and it seems to come through.
Mm-hmm.
So writing has always been my bread and butter. The industry is going through a huge transition right now. I think we've seen this more in print journalism, and I've done a lot of magazine writing in my life as well. I don't think books are changing as much as fast, but it is a new world out there. So I am very open to exploring, expanding, and finding many other ways to stay afloat in this business. I have a degree in comparative religions, and I'm looking now into an interfaith ministers program. Doesn't mean that I won't be writing the next book and writing all my life, but I'll be writing with some more letters after my name. So it's a continual growth process.
So do you have another book in mind,
though? You know, I actually have three books in mind. Maybe you can tell me which one I should write.
Okay.
One thing about my writing history that's kind of unusual is that I'm not a tremendous specialist, because I'm old enough that I remember when writers could just be writers. I was looking in an Aldous Huxley book not long ago, and when it said books by this author, he had so many of them that they were divided into categories. So there was fiction, we all know Brave New World, but nonfiction, poetry, biography, travel and adventure, children's, health. This man was all over the place.
Wow.
We call that, when we look at him, oh, he was a Renaissance man. Look at all that he could do. Nowadays, the industry and media seem to want everybody to just be in their own little tiny niche. So I believe that my niche is holistic spirituality, which pretty much encompasses everything. People would say that I have two kinds of books that I've written and two kinds of work that I've done as a journalist and as a speaker as well. One is spirituality, and the other is well-being. I've done a lot with diet and health, that kind of thing. So even though to me it's part of a piece, I probably need to be more specialized to keep going as the world changes. So here are the book ideas that I have. One is along the spiritual lines. I don't know the exact title. The working title is simply Sacred: 10 Power Principles to Anchor Your Life Through Times of Change. Another is a food book. I've been a vegan for a very long time. I have been eating predominantly raw food for a few years, and I have to say, I'm so much younger than I was 2 years ago. My whole life has changed. I feel obscenely fabulous. So I've thought about writing a book that is called The Look Great, Stay Thin, Never Age Diet. And finally, I have a third one that, as my husband says, well, this one has nothing to do with either meditating or eating vegetables, and that's a book about my beloved New York City. I want to call it The New York Edge and How to Get It, No Matter Where You Live. Because I look around, I'm an adopted New Yorker, and I see the people here with this little bit of savvy, this little bit of extra know-how that I wish I'd had all my life. And so that book is 100 little suggestions for things that New Yorkers know and that maybe lots of people would like to learn.
That sounds intriguing.
That's a tough one, trying to pick one out of there.
I don't know.
I'm sure they will all be well received, because they're all going to fill a need.
I would think that the New York one would have a wide audience, including people who want to move to New York for various reasons.
Well, I think so, and just also the idea that it's kind of America's city. I think it belongs to all of us. And as long as it's got that ability to bounce back, I mean, when I was first thinking about the book, it was before the Wall Street debacle and all that. And yet, I was down on Wall Street a couple of days ago, and those people are still there with their briefcases, trying to figure things out. So it's this wonderful resilience, and I think that's really something that we can all use regardless of where we're living.
Well, we saw that too after 9/11.
Absolutely.
You know, that they all pulled together and so forth, and that was really great. It was.
Yeah. Well, in our last few minutes, let's talk real quick about where listeners can learn more or be in contact with your work, buy your books.
Thank you. Well, my website is just my name, Victoria Moran, MORAN.com. Would be happy to have people visit. I do a free weekly e-zine, The Charmed Monday Minute, if anyone would like to subscribe to that. And there's also a special offer that's going right now. This is my summer reading special, and it's just going until Labor Day. If anyone would like to check out VictoriaMoran.com/charmed, and you have to do the /charmed or you'll just go to my regular site. But if you do VictoriaMoran/charmed and purchase a copy of Living a Charmed Life from your favorite online booksellers, so we have Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and IndieBound.com as the choices, then you can get up to 130 amazing downloadable gifts from other authors and teachers. Really amazed at the generosity. John Gray, Mariel Hemingway, Marcy Shymoff, all kinds of wonderful people offering everything from e-books to online courses to recipes that aren't in their regular books.
Wow.
So that's a kind of fun thing if anybody would like to check that out as well.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Great. So for our listeners that are aspiring writers themselves, what are the qualities that make you successful as a writer?
I believe that nobody should write if they could do anything else. I've heard that said to actors, and I think it's the same thing here.
Yeah.
I think if it's in your heart and you need to express it in words, then don't let anybody stop you. So I think that what has made me successful is that I really write from my heart. I sit down at the computer, and sometimes with a pen and paper still. If I'm really feeling blocked and nothing's coming, I'll write with a pen. But most days, I take the computer to a cafe. I do all my other work from home, but when I'm actually writing, when I'm going to court the muse, I need to get out in the world where I get that energy. And I just feel that I turn it on with this willingness to receive inspiration. And that doesn't mean that the first draft is fabulous. Of course, I think it's fabulous, and then I read it the next day and think, oh my goodness, this is so awful. But it's still the germ of it. And that I'm really, I think, just willing to be a vehicle for what wants to come through. And I just pray that that happens for the rest of my life, because this is a wonderful, wonderful profession. It's just such a great way to get to share what you, what you're passionate about, and ignite other people's passions at the same time.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, so I want to...
It has really been great.
Thank you so much for being with us.
When I looked at your list of questions, I thought, oh, this is the best radio show I've ever been on.
Oh, hey, all right.
You. We're better than Oprah. All right. No, she's not radio. Well, thank you so much for being with us. This has been really enjoyable. We really enjoyed your book.
We highly recommend it. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, very deep and wise. I kept thinking she could have easily framed it as herself being the next Deepak Chopra or something. I mean, I really felt nourished reading it.
Yeah.
So let's close with a quote from Caroline.
Okay, well, I'm going to take a quote from her, actually. I can find that page.
And as you're finding it, I'll let our listeners know, if you're listening on Friday, please stay tuned for James Moore and Planet Erstwhile. And if you're listening on Monday, stay tuned for The Colt Show with Stephen Colt.
Okay, this was from chapter 27 of her book, Put Fear in Its Place. And her lucky charm is, whatever is before you today that is a little bit scary, tend to that first thing. Very good advice.
That's good. Thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
upload.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.